Hello, and welcome to the Jacobite Podcast. Episode 19, Prelude to the 45. Well, I've finally got over the writer's block, and we've managed to get an episode ready for you. So here we go, without further ado, launching in to the infamous rising of the 45. Welcome to Europe in the 1740s. The War of the Austrian Succession is in full swing. It's not going to be the focus of the podcast, but it is important to know that the war itself was a pervasive force constantly spreading its influence across Europe. The security of the Hanoverian crown and the British state will be threatened by the Jacobite actions, but this rising is one small theatre in a continent-wide conflict. It is important, however, to provide a very quick run-through of British involvement up until 1744. The first casualty of the War of the Austrian Succession was Sir Robert Walpole in Britain. The man seemed to be the first Prime Minister. Since the war started, his influence had been on the wane, and despite winning his election, his own party's detractors gained in power, with several seeing him as corrupt and incapable of fighting or leading a war. In a vote on a by-election that Walpole had let known would be a vote of confidence in his administration, the opposition and the rivals in his own party engineered a loss, so Walpole would see that the writing was on the wall, and he duly resigned. King George II would keep him on as a lord and senior advisor, but his time running the country was over. In the war in Europe, George's territory of Hanover had claimed neutrality, but given that Britain was involved, troops were sent to Hanover and to defend George's territories overseas. This irritated some in Britain, who felt that British resources were being spent on matters of a purely Hanoverian nature. But like any other time in history, when there's a chance to stick it to the French, the English will jump at the chance, and they voted Britain into the war. This, of course, is a massive overgeneralisation, but some of these wars are kind of dry, so I need to make a joke now and again. George II is probably the best known in this war for being the last British monarch to lead his forces onto the field of battle, as commander of British troops at the Battle of Dettingen. Running low on supplies and heading for their main base in Hanau, British, Hanoverian and Austrian troops, roughly to the strength of 35,000, were met on the road by roughly 23,000 French troops. The British and their allies were taken completely by surprise during their retreat, and things got even worse when the French commander, the Duc de Noël, sent a further 12,000 troops to attempt to catch them in a pincer movement. In trying to flee, the French cavalry, against orders, charged into the running Allied lines. The French artillery held fire, not wanting to fire their guns on their own compatriots, and seizing the opportunity, some of the British infantry held their line, whilst Hanoverian artillery and Austrian cavalry attempted, and in areas succeeded, to smash through the French cavalry. The battle itself was a cause for celebration by George, with Te Deums being said in British churches, but to all intents and purposes, despite driving the French into a river, this was far more of a successful retreat than an actual victory. Nonetheless, the French were shaken by it, and only continued to pose a threat due to the inaction of George and his allies. The French saw it as vital to neutralise the British forces, and to this end, allied with Spain. King Louis XV of France formally deepened its relationship with the House of Bourbon in Spain under his uncle King Philip V. Known as the Treaty of Fontainebleau, or the Second Pacte de Famille, it was signed in October 1743, and its provisions further deepened cooperation between the two Bourbon families. But it also created a united front against the British. It was also decided between the two the quickest way to remove Britain was to invade it. The plan was set to launch an invasion of Britain in a combined Franco-Spanish naval flotilla in February 1744. This force, which would also be composed of around 10,000 French troops, including the Royal Écossais, the Scottish volunteers who had fled abroad. Their aim was to depose King George II and restore James Francis Edward Stuart as King James III of Britain. To this end, an invitation was sent to Rome for the Jacobite Prince of Wales, Charles Edward Stuart, to join the invasion fleet. To make sure he was there, a plan was hatched. On January 9th, 1744, Charles and his brother were to head out on another hunting trip, but this was going to be unlike any of the others. The 23-year-old prince and his 18-year-old brother Prince Henry were all headed to Albano, but Charles was ready early and, waiting for his brother, decided to head out early with only his servants and a small retinue, including James Murray. Along the route, Murray fell from his horse, and whilst the hunting group assisted him, Charles and a couple of servants got ahead of the rest of them. But when the team caught up at him at Albano, Charles wasn't there. People were wondering what exactly had gone on. Except, of course, for the fact that all the major players, from James Murray, Charles, Henry, and even King James, were in on this little ruse. To the people that knew, the whole hunting trip was an elaborate cover. James played the worried parent to illustrate the fact he didn't know where Charles was, as well as handily demonstrating an Oscar-winning case of presenting plausible deniability. Murray's fall from his horse was orchestrated to allow the prince and his most trusted followers to get away, and Prince Henry wrote letters to his family and arranged for boar meat to be sent to Cardinal Acquaviva in Rome. This all had to happen to obscure to the followers and agents from Britain that Charles was en route to France, accepting an invite that Louis XV had made to come to France and plot 1744's invasion of England, and tacking a political justification and some much-needed legitimacy to a Franco-Spanish invasion plot. Charles hadn't told Henry of the secret ride, but once informed, his younger brother played his dutiful part in maintaining the ruse. Charles and some men rode on to France, disguised in Neapolitan dress to elude British spies and attempts to catch him or turn him back. He rode for 5 days and nights to Savona, where he caught a boat to Antibes in the south of France. By the end of January, Charles rode into Paris to the house of Lord John Sempill, who'd contacts at the French court, who were moving ahead with potential invasion plans. Charles wrote to his father, who was happy his son was safe, but expressed concern that Louis had not been to see Charles personally or invited Charles to Versailles. Eventually, wanting to get closer to the action, Charles travelled to Gravelines, a small port town near Dunkirk. Charles could see the transports being loaded and men preparing to sail. As an initial thrust of the offensive, the French navy were sailing from the port of Brest and attempting to draw fire and attract attention away from Marshal Saxe and his landing fleet. Charles wrote excitedly of intrigues for Mr. Fisher to his father, King James, Mr. Fisher being Charles's codename for himself. But much like prior plans, there was to be sore disappointment. Admiral Rouquefouy and his fleet sailed to England, but thanks to spies in the French Foreign Ministry, the British knew they were coming. A Royal Navy fleet engaged the French, but there was no clear winner until Marshal Saxe's invasion fleet attempted to cross, and Mother Nature decided otherwise. A catastrophic storm rocked the English Channel and sent British and French ships running to safe harbour. Now the British could just head to Southampton or Portsmouth, but the French caught the full brunt of the storm. They limped back to port, but the damage was done and the cat was well and truly out of the bag. The British now firmly knew French intentions, and they diverted troops away from the European campaign back to defend Britain and calling in Marshal George Wade to lead the troops repelling the French advance. After limping back to port, the French ended up diverting their troops back towards the European campaigns. For now, there would be no invasion to support the Jacobites in 1744. Unfortunately, it seemed to have escaped Charles's notice as he cheerfully wrote to his father in Rome stating the mission had suffered a temporary setback, that he'd be setting sail to Britain to reclaim the Stuart throne. But as time went on, even supporters were keen to try and inject a hefty dose of realism. The Earl Marischal wrote many letters to Charles that had all established the same thing. The French had pulled the plug on the invasion. There was no regrouping. They were done. Charles resented the Earl's letters. He called them almost books in length. He saw all of this as setbacks, but not the end. You'd call it youthful optimism, willful ignorance, or misinformation, and in some way, it's a mix of all three. But Charles remained optimistic. In all honesty, I have a hard time deciding which of the three it would be when writing this, because you can argue any one of them. Charles may have been trying, as would occur later, to rally men who were despondent and facing insurmountable odds. On the other hand, it could be said that even Charles could see that troops were being moved from Gravelines, and the French administration's response to him had become increasingly vague and non-committal about plans for future invasions. But in all fairness to Charles, the French court at this time was riven with petty intrigues and internecine power plays. It could be that Tassin, the Secretary of State under King Louis, was not able to influence the whims of his monarch. Perhaps it was simply the case that Charles didn't have access to all this, and that the French, in a bid to keep their guest from doing anything rash or offending him, instead kept their answers vague. It was then left to others to bring the prince's aspirations crashing down to earth. Though given Charles's reaction, my perceived French fear of him doing something rash wasn't far off. He wrote to Maréchal and ordered for a transport and preparations to be made for an invasion. If France weren't going to help, he'd do it himself. But the Earl Maréchal quickly disabused him of this notion. Not only was Britain now aware of a plot or any potential invasions, but without French support, they were bound to fail. Add to this, due to previous rebellions, the government's Disarming Act had removed privately owned weapons forcibly taken from Scotland. So even if the plan was to land there, they'd have to take enough guns to arm everyone, and given that after the invasion plans were revealed, the government had suspended habeas corpus and gone on summarily arresting known or suspected Jacobites, they might not have that many supporters left. Charles initially thought this all small potatoes until he saw the reasoning and quietly left Gravelines for Paris, arriving in around April. Once Charles arrived in the French capital, he was rapidly considered an embarrassing afterthought to a failed plot. He kept under French surveillance, but he lived in a modest house with a small retinue and even smaller income. Charles's tutor, Thomas Sheridan, was sent to the prince by way of consolation, though sending a man with a history of strokes across a continent so he could add another one en route might not have been wise. But he went at the behest of the prince, because despite the chipper attitude and attempts to believe this had all been a setback, Charles was beginning to grow despondent and lose hope. For not only was this prince growing short of money, and the fact that the French pension hadn't been forthcoming exacerbated matters, this lack of funds forced Charles to throw himself at the mercy of moneylenders to stay afloat. Added to this, which also caused the prince no end of strife, was the constant bickering and feuding amongst various Jacobite exile factions. Now, in many revolutionary or insurrectionary groups, people of differing political ideologies can put aside many differences to unite against a common enemy. Unfortunately, nobody seems to have told the Jacobites this. John Murray of Broughton arrived in France in 1745 to find Charles retired to his cousin Fitzjames's estate after finally losing patience with the French. The prince had seen that the French king attempted to send him to Flanders to fight in the war. This was vetoed by Maréchal, who A. didn't want to see the Jacobites lose their main heir in a war for European hegemony between France and the German states, and B. becoming the heir to the restored Stuart throne is kind of a hard sell when you've just been on the side of the French shooting at your subjects. Now, before Murray of Broughton arrived then, Charles had begun to grow increasingly frustrated with French inaction to the honest cause and the stern patrician caution of Maréchal, and began to fall in line with his Irish courtiers, John O'Sullivan and George Kelly, two Irish Jacobites who Charles found to be smart, loyal, and a breath of fresh air from his normal entourage. Now, this was a minor flash in the pan so far as the current Jacobite situation, but we will see a long-burning resentment between the Jacobite factions, predominantly the Scots and Irish Jacobite factions. But back to Murray. John Murray of Broughton had come to France to see the prince because he and his drinking club buddies in Edinburgh had wanted Charles to be made fully aware of what Jacobite support in Scotland looked like. When he met Charles, Murray heard him talk of being met by 20,000 men and being swept to power on a wave of glory. Given that he'd all but added in a ticker tape parade and rivers of chocolate for how fantastical this was to John Murray, much to the chagrin of Lord Semple, who'd given him the figures. Semple rubbished Murray as an ignorant fool, but Murray managed to get a second meeting with Charles alone. It was here he laid it all out for him. How it would actually be was the number of troops would be 4,000 in Scotland at the most. They would be underarmed, some would have arms, but most were without. The surefire way of gaining support was Charles arriving with a large contingent of French forces. But without a force like this, not only would many loyal people stay home, but wavering chiefs like Simon Fraser, the Lord Lovat, would stay home or even back the government to avoid any comeback. But before anyone comes down too hard on Charles, Murray explained all about this one-on-one after the later risings, so spoiler alert, he tries to clear himself of any potential blame for errors made. Anyone who heard Charles tell it, Murray all but rolled out the welcome wagon in Scotland and all of its lords to sweep Charles to Edinburgh, who was telling the truth. That's left to history. But I'm willing to bet Murray of Broughton didn't walk up to a boss's kid and tell him that his dreams were just a pile of junk. It was in this time that Charles started to formulate his plot, that if he would just get to Scotland and start the rising, France would come in out of loyalty and Christian unity to restore the just monarchs of the British crown. Word reached James that his son was contemplating this move, so he wrote to him that no matter how advantageous this situation was beginning to appear for opposition to the House of Hanover, he wished to impress on Charles just how risky this venture was, because if it paid off, great, but if it failed, it was likely to lead to the end of the Jacobites, and that perhaps it might be better to exercise caution against rash actions that could damage the cause and alienate their potential allies. But whilst Charles and his father corresponded, and Louis attempted to keep Charles out of the way in France, actions in Europe would dominate everything else. The British forces in Europe were now under the command of King George's son, William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland. He had some combat experience, fighting and being wounded alongside men at the Battle of Dettingen, but he was still a young, inexperienced 20-something when he had left London and his command there to defend against the French threat in 1744, in order to take on the enemy face to face in Europe. The British forces were camped in May 1745 in the vicinity of the village of Fontenoy, which is about 5 miles from the modern-day Belgian town of Tournai. The British and their allies were aiming to relieve the French siege of Tournai. At Dettingen, the allies may have successfully fought a fighting retreat, but here at Fontenoy the allies were fractured, indecisive, facing an excellent commander in Marshal Maurice de Saxe, who had commanded being carried around the field in incredible pain from edema. The young Cumberland ordered recon missions but missed the Redoubt d'Eau, a huge fortified position by the Bois de Barry. This, combined with other failures and infantry positioning, meant that Cumberland would have a long, lethal grind to get to French positions. Additional troops didn't get cleared from the woods of the Bois de Barry by Dutch troops, and Cumberland did not regroup or appreciate just how many and how dug in the French were. As Allied artillery opened up, the infantry marched on Fontenoy. Only then did the British see that they were against a dug-in, superior French force. The Allied advance in this direction stalled, as did a Dutch advance into Fontenoy town. As the Dutch pulled back, British troops moved up into the middle. As they advanced, the British were left alone against the French, at least in their eyes. They made inroads against French soldiers, but Saxe had a backup plan. French cavalry pushed the Allies back and gave the French infantry time to regroup. Leading the French counterattack was the Irish Brigade. As French infantry fired grapeshot into Allied lines, the Irish Jacobite force played the white cockade and screamed, "Remember Limerick and English treachery." Over 650 of the men known as the Wild Geese died fighting for France, but France pushed Britain back and forced the Allies into a retreat. King Louis XV was jubilant, going so far as to promote men on the battlefield. For France, this led them developing a clear and decisive advantage against the Allies. British reports wrote home that the Duke of Cumberland had shown bravery in combat and was let down by the Dutch, who had retreated from the fortified Fontenoy French. It was said that the Duke showed great pains at his losses and the retreat suffered, but in truth he sat in his camp, crying tears of rage. Cumberland had been young, headstrong, and he hadn't listened to advice. The British made this look like a victorious retreat, like a 200-year anticipation of Dunkirk. But the truth was the Allies were in disarray, and Marshal Saxe now had the road open to the Netherlands. For Jacobites, this appeared to be a cause of celebration. Their Irish contingent had given the Hanovers a bloody nose and on the back foot on the continent. The time for some would seem ripe to launch a strike on Britain and seize the crown from the usurpers. But to some observers, there appeared to be a hitch in the plan. Up until this point, the Jacobites were a component of French campaigns, waved as a boogeyman of given men and arms to fight proxy wars, waged to draw English and then later British attentions so that France could further her own interests. But France was winning. They didn't need to cause trouble in George and Cumberland's backyard. The Jacobites and their invasion were surplus to requirement. Charles must have sensed that, or his advisers were able to tell him not only were the French continuing to fob him off with excuses, but when Murray of Broughton returned to Scotland, word reached Charles in France that Murray's drinking club had almost to a man said they could not, in good conscience, support an invasion unless Charles was accompanied with bundles of cash, boatloads of guns, and battalions of troops. Faced with all this, it must have seemed to Charles that he had to take swift and decisive action. His plan, which he placed as his plan B, should France's scheme fall through. He wrote to Murray, stating it was still his intention to land in Scotland, possibly on the Isle of Mull, and raise local forces to start a rising and eventually march on London to restore his father as king. There was a need for utmost secrecy, as if King Louis or his father got word of what he was planning, there would be moves made to stop it. Whilst entertaining himself in society masquerades and balls put on to divert him, Charles plotted. Much of the money he borrowed was now used to fund his rising, using middlemen and trying to work to acquire the arms his Scottish kinsmen had said they would require. By July 1745, Charles had around 1,500 muskets, 1,800 swords, powder, shot, artillery, and a modest amount of French currency. Charles also called upon a French naval officer and slave trader operating out of Nantes by the name of Antoine Walsh. Walsh commissioned a privateer by the name of Du Tellet. Once he sent word to Charles that everything was set, Charles ordered Sheridan, Kelly, and O'Sullivan to Nantes, bringing with him the various medicines, books, clothes, and furniture pieces, all listed as trading merchandise for a captain headed to the West Indies, but vital for a prince on the campaign. Charles was accompanied by his tutor Thomas Sheridan, his friend and Protestant clergyman George Kelly, Francis Strickland, a Catholic courtier in Rome and the one Englishman on this expedition with Charles, who'd currently left Rome as James didn't like him, especially given as he'd considered converting Charles to Anglicanism, as the best chance of securing a Stuart succession. Sir John MacDonald, a cavalryman who had served with the French cavalry, Agnes MacDonald, clansman of the MacDonalds of Kinlochmoidart and acting as aide-de-camp to Prince Charles, and William Murray, the Marquess of Tullibardine, who had fought for the cause in 1715, led a force in 1719. These seven men joined the prince in Nantes to prepare for departure. With his arms stored and ships ready to depart, the prince had a messenger dispatched to Rome on the eve of his departure. This was partly to prevent the plan being discovered by British forces who, despite knowing there were rumblings of something, there was no concrete evidence. The other, slightly more mundane and personal reason was he only sent the letter as he left to prevent either his father or King Louis from finding out and stopping him. Charles's letter was a justification of his actions. He wrote that the Scottish Jacobites had invited him to come with as many arms and as much money as he could carry. Charles told James that honour dictated he either abandon all pretence of restoring the Stuarts and return to Rome and languish, or join the men in Scotland, fight for the family and the cause, and if he didn't stand with their supporters now, they may never support them again. Charles honestly believed the best thing to do was a hard, fast, sharp strike against the British forces to enable the Jacobites to destabilise the Hanoverian regime, and that swift victories would guarantee that the French knew they were capable of doing it and encourage actual support and material gains in terms of troops and additional arms. And so it was, on July 15th, 1745, that Charles, the seven men of his entourage and 100 troops boarded the Du Tellet and the Elizabeth and set sail for the Western Isles. Next time, we will join the prince and his men as they sail for Britain to gain support for his rebellion and try to mount a massive push to regain the throne for his family and end the campaign they had undertaken for over half a century, when they start the rising of 1745.